FT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Daniel Williams.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And tonight on Queer Voices, Dwight Silverman of KPFT's Technology Bites and the Houston Chronicle will be joining us to discuss how public you should be on electronic media. Then in News Wrap, the Obama administration has announced a new immigration policy that could end deportation threats against foreign gays and lesbians who are in same-gender unions with U.S. citizens. In Rhode Island, 9 gay and lesbian couples have registered their civil partnerships now that they have the right to do so in that state. Meanwhile, activists in Maine and Oregon are working on petition drives to put a marriage equality initiative on the ballot next November. After News Wrap, the horrific stabbing of Aaron Shearhorn in front of one of our community bars has led friends Doug Anderson and Alan Everett to start a community patrol. They'll be here to discuss that. At 10 o'clock, an in-depth interview with Dr. Ann J. Robinson, who is the executive director of the Montrose Counseling Center. Dr. Robinson is involved in community planning and coalition development in mental health, substance abuse treatment, HIV services, anti-violence services, and health education. And then in the feature segment from This Way Out, a follow-up to the story called Zach Has Two Mommies. Zach Walls is now a student at the University of Iowa. And if the hate mongers were right, he would be displaying all of the horrific effects of being raised by, gasp, two lesbians. Instead, he has become an internet sensation by being, well, sensational. Jack?
Well, pretty packed show tonight. First of all, I want to thank everybody who made a pledge last week to KPFT and hope you will fulfill them. Second of all, Daniel is also a blogger.
Yes, I am, Jack. You can follow me online at legislativequery.com. That's query with two E's. And we had an interesting story coming up in Houston just today. The Houston Chronicle reported that 309th Family Court Associate Judge Charlie Prine has issued a ruling in a custody case involving a gay father. Now, there were no allegations of abuse from either party as part of the custody hearings, but apropos of nothing and at the request of none of the parties, Judge Prine Father William Flowers from leaving his children in the care of any male who is not a blood relative or relative by adoption. The ruling could potentially restrict the father from even leaving his children with a teacher or Sunday school teacher or anything of that nature if they were a male and unrelated.
That's sort of broad statement, isn't it, though?
It's a very broad statement, and the Chronicle article goes through great depth to describe it as unprecedented. They spoke with several lawyers. It's wonderful. It's online. You can see the link on my website, legislativequery.com. One of the things I wanted to be sure to point out to people is that Judge Prine is an associate judge in the 309th Court. He's appointed by the presiding judge of that court, Judge Dean, who was elected for the first time last November. And this is one of those little bitty races down at the bottom of the ballot that nobody pays attention to because they're family courts or they're justices of the peace or they're criminal courts. And it's hard. There's so many of them, it's hard to keep up with them. But this is why it matters, because no election has the potential to come back and bite you on the butt personally the way that these little family court races do. And the presiding judge in this case only won by 78,000 votes, which in Harris County is not that many people.
Well, isn't that a bit much? Now, dare I say that they're Republican?
Judge Dean did run as a Republican. She did have a Democratic opponent, Bill Rice, who was endorsed by the GLBT political caucus. However, he lost.
So So that we're getting what we didn't go out and vote for.
And that's my point exactly, and the point I made on my post on legislativequery.com today, that we have to pay attention to those little races. We cannot abdicate those races at the bottom of the ballot just because we don't understand them. We have a responsibility as a community to educate ourselves on those races and to get involved in the process.
And some organizations do endorse on those all the way down there. In fact, that's one of the reasons the GLBT political caucus has been famous for, is because so many people don't vote or just vote the party, and when they endorse on those races, they have a lot more power.
And most of the big cities in Texas have some sort of organization that does that kind of screening and endorsement process. There's the Dallas Gay and Lesbian Alliance. There's the Fort Bend GLBT political caucus. This information is not hard to find, but it requires us going out and looking for it and getting involved. And if you do happen to live in an area where there's not an organization like that, any candidate worth their salt will have a phone number or an email out there that you can pick up and ask them a question. And if they won't answer it, that should tell you something.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Receive what you can conceive, you will achieve.
A song called Believe. That was David Dubb from the album of the same name, released in 2009. This is Queer Voices.
We are in this age where a lot of us are very public, and some of us who are activists have been public for a long time. But not everybody in our community necessarily wants to be so public. We still don't have protection from either the city, state, or county. So being open about yourself is some challenges. And of course, we have activists want everybody to be out, but you're not necessarily able to do that, especially if you're young, especially if you're living with your family. And this whole explosion of social media has changed everything. And with us this evening is Dwight Silverman. And if you don't know who he is, you should, because there's a wonderful show on Wednesday evenings called Technology Bites, which Dwight is part of it. And Dwight is also a writer in the Houston Chronicle. And you are also syndicated in the other Hearst papers?
Yeah, a lot of the content that appears in the Chronicle, particularly on the website, ends up getting used at a lot of the other Hearst sites. So, for example, the Seattle PI, Post-Intelligencer, which is now a web-only newspaper, uses my column, runs my blog on their site.
So I'm asking for some advice on this, and you also have children, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know if you had to deal with them and talk to them about what they should put up and what they shouldn't put up.
You know, it's real interesting. My kids were raised here in Houston when, for most of the time, we were living up on the northwest side of town, like right next to the Compaq campus when it was Compaq. And they had computers in the schools there at that time because it was, you know, the Compaq parents up there demanded it. And that's one reason I moved up there. So they had always had computers both at home and at school. And one of the ways we dealt with this at home was we made sure our computers were all in a public place. So rather than them having a computer in their room, there was essentially like a computer room. And if you wanted to come use a computer, there were several in there because I would review them and I would have multiple machines available. And they would come and sit down and they would get on at the time, kind of there where they were was their old America Online. And they would sit down and that's how they did their computing. And we were always present to be able to say, well, you know, you don't want to do this, you don't want to do that. And I think the thing that we gave them, that made it easiest for them was that they knew when they were not comfortable with something or if they didn't know exactly how to proceed, they could ask. And so rather than say, do this, don't do this, you know, we simply were available and had an atmosphere of being able to say, you know, Dad, should I put this up? Or Mom, should I put this up? Or should I say, this person's saying this to me? And we really never had a problem.
You're also in a particular environment where the parents were also computer literate, and this is not always the case.
Yes, yeah, and that's an issue. You know, in a lot of cases, the kids know more than the parents. And so the kids get guidance from other kids, or they get guidance from, you know, a variety of sources that may not necessarily be, you know, the best for them. And so, I think in this era, it's part of your duty as a parent to kind of learn what your kids know about the internet and to bring yourself up to speed as best you can. I kind of think if you're just as, you know, you need to be a good driver to teach your kids how to drive, you need to know how to use the internet in order to teach your kids how to use the internet.
Well, that's a little bit difficult when both parents are working in many situations and sometimes they don't have the time to learn all the ins and outs of the computers, and the kids are around computers all day long in many cases.
Well, they're in, you know, parents are too, because you're, you know, there aren't many jobs anymore where you don't use a computer. If you're an office worker, you certainly are using, you know, almost everybody now is what's called a knowledge worker, and so they use a computer at work. And yes, it's just like television. You know, you can't, it's hard for a parent to say, you know, to expect a parent to say, well, I'm going to know what my kids watch, because if you're not there, you don't know what they watch. But if you give enough guidance, if you kind of make them understand kind of what the risks are, and you can explain it in a way that they can understand it, I think that's probably a pretty good foundation.
Now, you were talking about having all your computers centralized where you live, but nowadays we also have smartphones.
Right,
which are
right.
It's somewhat of a
more difficult environment. I think the trick with smartphones is that they're not cheap. You know, if you have a phone that's connected to the internet all the time, you're probably paying between $20 and $30 a month in order to have that capability per phone. So I know a lot of parents, simply can't afford smartphones, and that's kind of a control on it. There are kids certainly who are carrying smartphones. So it's not as ubiquitous, I don't think, yet as computers in the home are, but that certainly makes it a lot more difficult. And of course, there's the issue of using text messaging, which is available on even the cheapest phones.
The other thing I heard recently was that sometimes kids share, they are so friendly with their friends that they sometimes share their passwords.
Yes, and you know, one of the things I think that we're headed for a serious wake-up call in this culture is people generally don't pay enough attention to computer security. You've seen in the news lately a lot of really high-profile hacking incidents. Everybody from Google was hacked. The CIA has been hacked. The defense contractors are being hacked. And, you know, there are a couple of ways this is happening. One, the prevalence of spyware, of malware, where people click on the wrong thing and it installs something on their computer that allows people to get into it. But also, a lot of times, people are just tricked into giving up their passwords. This is called social engineering, where you're essentially made to do something that you normally wouldn't do, and people kind of don't think much about their passwords. You know, I run the blog network at the Chronicle. I'm the editor who runs all the blogs, and trying to get people to use strong passwords on our blogs is like pulling teeth. You know, they want to use their first name 123. You know, and I try to impress upon them that, you know, we've never been hacked and I want to keep it that way and use a strong password. People just don't take it seriously enough.
Even with a strong password, though, there was a video, I don't know if you've seen this or not, that I think it was LulzSec or someone released that was a video that was 10,000 passwords. It was a video of passwords that they had gotten, I think, from part of their Pentagon hacking. And someone had compiled them all into one thing and didn't like have it attached to any particular identities or whatever.
Right.
It's all these passwords, and you could stop it intermittently. And there were not an insignificant number of those that were the so-called strong passwords. So there's still, you know.
Well, in the case of the LulzSec hacks, all it takes is for them to be able to get access into that database and then pull it down. That's not necessarily a matter of any of those individuals doing something wrong. They just happen to have that on that database at the time. One of the toughest things about computer security is that people have so many different logins,
yes,
that they tend to use the same password for everything. So if you are compromised at one site, you know, and they see your email address, then they try the password that they've picked up from that particular hack and start applying it at other sites. And so if you use that, say, at iTunes, that same password, you use that same password at Amazon.com, then suddenly they have access to your account where you spend money or your banking.
HR departments now check a lot of people's Facebook,
right,
when they're have somebody applying for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any guidelines on what people should?
Well, this probably speaks to my generation, but I've often said, you know, don't engage in any behavior that you wouldn't want to see on the front page of the newspaper, right? Because Facebook is the new front page of the newspaper. And, you know, people are, I think to have yourself taken with a picture of a beer or a drink at a party and you're having a good time, I think people, you know, understand that people go to parties. I don't think that's, but if that's kind of there all the time, and if you are, you know, kind of doing handstands on the keg, you know, and that type of thing, you have to think about, you know, you may not be in a profession right now where somebody would care that much about that, but what are you going to be doing 10 years or 20 years from now? And the internet is forever.
Exactly. And I guess people don't realize but there are places where they keep this stuff, the history.
Right. And, you know, you can go in and you can delete your Facebook account. But that it's very easy for anybody to right click on a picture on Facebook, do save image as, and they've got a copy of that photo. And who knows where that could end up. So, you know, there's a picture of me on the internet that was taken. Somebody who was doing a scavenger hunt, and they had to rub the head of a bald person, and they had to get taken with have their picture taken with an author. So there's a photo of me somewhere on the internet, and you can find this if you look hard enough, of two women, one of them rubbing my stomach, the other rubbing my head, and me holding a copy of a book I wrote. And it's the stupidest looking picture. And if you have no context for what's happening, it looks like really goofy, you know. I can explain that picture pretty well, but that's the, you know, there's no context for that. And so when you're posting pictures of yourself and kind of what you're doing, you have to kind of think about how someone will look at that and say, well, what, you know, what does that picture mean?
I mean, like HR is not going to ask you for a context, are they? I mean, they're just going to say, oh, well, that person is, you know, no good for a company.
Well, you know, when you go for an interview at a job and you sit down with the person who's interviewing you, who may or may not end up being your boss. It could be somebody from another department. It could be someone from HR. You have no idea what that person's biases are. You have no idea where that person is coming from. And so, you know, if you're sitting down for an interview, you kind of want to present the most neutral face you can because you don't know what that person's bias is. You can say, well, he or she should not think this way, but, you know, should and the way they are often two different things. And so the same thing, I think, is true with putting information about yourself and images and videos and so forth on the internet. You don't know how anybody is going to react to that who may ultimately be have some impact on your life.
So, I mean, you can do all this kind of stuff. And, like, as a kid who grew up on the internet, I basically am almost never in it under my real name. It seems to me like a terrible idea. But as a result, I have lots and lots of, like, names I may have used or have, like, used so long ago that they're gone in the past. I don't know the password to the pages anymore. I mean, is it at all likely that some detritus of like a previous internet persona can come back and haunt me?
Well, if it's not attached to your real name, you know, there's less of a chance of that. There's a really interesting debate going on right now as a result of Google Plus. Google Plus is a new social network that Google has started. It's very successful, very fast. I think the last number I saw, they have 25 million users, and it's only been around for like 5 or 6 weeks. And one of the things that they do is they require that you use a real name on the site.
And how would they know?
Well, you know, it's that actually has become a problem because, for example, we have one of the members of Technology Bytes. His name is Groovehouse. His real name is Eric. But he goes by Groovehouse. Everybody knows him as Groovehouse. He has an established identity. So he went on to Google Plus. He set himself up as Groovehouse, and Google Plus kicked him off because it wasn't a real name. He came back to them and said, okay, here's my real name, and I use Groovehouse as a handle, and I use it. It's associated with some of the other things I do. I'm a part-time photographer. And so then they said, well, because Groove House is associated with your photography, that's a business, and we're not accepting businesses yet. And so it became he's still isn't back on Google Plus, you know, where a lot of his friends are and are interacting. And so the reason that Google wants to do this is that once they want to avoid kind of the issue of trolling. They want to have a more civil place. Facebook requires real names as well. But, you know, there's a lot of people on Facebook who are using pseudonyms. I think what Facebook wants is for you to have a real sounding name. So this whole debate has arisen around the use of real names in social media. The idea being that it may or may not produce a more civil discussion, but also it marginalizes people who may have something to say online but can't say it with their real name.
Well, and this also goes to the thing where let's say a woman's being abused and wants to start a new identity.
Right.
Or there's lots of people in the commercial media who use different names than their real names, and they may not actually legally be called that name.
Right. Right.
Or a very interesting one pertaining to our particular community is if someone's transitioning, how do, like, you know, them trying to establish their new identity and, retroactively change their old identity and trying to get all that stuff in line.
Those are incredibly complex human decisions.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, is that when you're dealing with a computer network, and a lot of times the people who invented the computer network or the engineers who are running it, it's a one and zero world. You know, it's one or the other, black or white. And so it's, I think what you're going to end up seeing is that Google Plus is going to figure out the route in which it needs to go. And right now they're being like real hard line. They're digging in their heels and they're not backing down on this. And there is quite a bit of debate going on about it. And particularly since the people who are early adopters on Google Plus are the kind of people who are going to get passionate about this kind of debate. I mean, particularly in the tech community, there's a long tradition of handles, gaming handles and network handles, which handles here being a name, you know, a fake name. And so this is like the wrong audience with which Google Plus is picking a fight.
Right. And of course, we also have people who have drag names in this community that use them and are, you know, entertained by them and raise money. And
well, the interesting thing is that like Facebook, Google Plus seems to be preferring real sounding names. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no real way to check it. They're not taking a credit card from you. You know, they're not doing anything like that. But they are kind of looking for real sounding names. One of the bad things about it is that they seem to have a bias towards English sounding names.
Right.
So if you have an unusual name, say that you may be of Czech descent, and you're using an unusual name that you wouldn't recognize here, in some cases, those accounts have been suspended. It's possible, and knowing Google, it's likely that that's an automated process, that it's looking at, you know, letter and syllable combinations and going, that's not real, and flagging it. And Google has come in and restored accounts, so my suspicion is it's automated and they're coming back in and looking at it. But again, that's a bias towards English sounding names, and these are things that I don't think that they thought out necessarily when they set out to build this network, but they sure are learning it now.
Being a person that was quoted by your colleague as being north of 40, the older population, how are they adapting to all of this new stuff? Do you have any knowledge of that?
Well, what's real? I think
now you do this professionally,
right? And I think that there's kind of two camps. There are a lot of older people who have really embraced it. In fact, I'm teaching a class at the University of Houston on social media and journalism. And the second day of class, we're going to go into the history of social media. And social media goes back really back to the days of computer bulletin boards back in the 80s, where individuals set up these communication nodes and you dialed into it and posted messages. And those were kind of the original social networks on a very low scale.
Telnet
was kind of a network of them. They essentially, you bought the software or you got it for free in some cases. You ran it on your computer. You plugged your phone line into a modem and people dialed into your computer and left messages. And a lot of people, a lot of older people began like that. There are a lot of people, veterans, who have been around, you know, for a long time, and that's how they started getting online. And the same thing with AOL in the 90s and the early 2000s. So there's a large number of people who've been doing it for a long time. A lot of older people also, particularly if they're not able to get around very well, if they are, for some reason are confined to the house, this becomes a gateway to the world for them. They have friendships, they have, deep relationships, complex relationships online. And there are people who look at that and go, oh, you know, that's kind of pathetic. It's not a real life, except if you are interacting with people and you have friends and you have relationships and it's fulfilling, yeah, it can be a real life.
You know, there's a real interesting parallel there, because some GLBT people who are young, who don't feel they can be out with their family, the radio used to be the thing that penetrated the closet door. Now,
right,
it is the computer,
right,
that can do that.
Right. It allows you kind of, there's that famous... there's that famous cartoon from The New Yorker of one dog sitting at a computer and another sitting next to it, and the dog has his hand on the keyboard. He's looking down at the other dog, and he says, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog."
Exactly. Yes, I remember seeing
that. That is kind of a great truism. Nobody knows who you really are. You could be who you want to be. You may choose to be you, or you may choose to be the person that you want to be.
Or the great internet truism, there are no real girls on the internet.
That's right. That's right.
Well, where do you see the future going? I mean, I know this is a complex question, but is it going to get easier to do these things? Is it going to be more invasive?
What I think will happen is it'll be kind of blended into everything that you do online. Everything will have some kind of social aspect to it. You see that more and more now. Right now, it's relatively primitive. Almost every website has a Twitter button, has a like button for Facebook. But what will happen is you will, if you choose to, you will be able to easily see the things that interest you, that your friends are looking at on almost every site. Amazon has done this for a long time. There was a company that started up, and it went away quickly because it kind of went too far too fast, that let you share your credit card transactions with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bought something and they were part of this network, they could see what you bought and even how much you paid for it. They wouldn't see your credit card number, but it was a way of, it was, similar to going in and saying, hey, I bought this new CD, at Best Buy, and I really like it. It's just the equivalent of doing that, except it was done through credit card transactions. Well, that creeped too many people out, and it didn't last very
long. Yet Netflix is able to do it on a softer way.
Right, right. And so, but I think what you'll see is that will become ubiquitous, and that will become commonplace, and we won't think about it. Just whatever we do, if we want to share it with our friends, we'll be able to do it.
Well, the thing is, it's almost... never, it's not a matter of if you want to share it with your friends. It's like all these things now are, you have to opt out of them, and it's usually a little bit of doing to figure out that you can opt out of something, that you don't want everything to go out to your friends. It's like all these things are set automatically to your friends know what you're into. And you can see on our website that you don't think that you've allowed them any sort of access on to your profiles or whatever, but there's some sort of cookie that may list, this person read this article, and that other friends in your Facebook network would see that. And that, to me, is already going too far. And I think I've set it up, but I don't necessarily know, because I can't see what they're saying.
It's it's pretty complex, particularly something like Facebook. If you go into Facebook's privacy settings and all the various checkboxes, and you know, in this category you have 20 checkboxes, in this category,
but it changes all the time.
And it changes. You have to go back and look periodically. And you know, sites like Facebook will periodically send you a note that says, "Our privacy policy has changed. Please read it." Well, nobody reads it.
But what
you should do when you see that is you should go into the privacy settings in Facebook, because it probably means something has changed in there, and you should go in there and look at it. And a site that is thoughtful and that does the right thing will ask you to opt in for the kinds of things you're talking about, Summer, but you're right, that doesn't always happen. It should.
Dwight, it's been a pleasure having you on, and I certainly appreciate the conversation. And I would recommend anybody who is interested in this is listen to Technology Bites, which is on Wednesdays at...
Wednesdays at 8 o'clock, from 8 to 10, here in KPFT.
And your column is usually on Tuesdays, but you do a lot more than just the Tuesday column.
My column runs Tuesday in the print edition and then appears Wednesday online at cron.com. I also do a tech blog, and it's called Tech Blog, and I write in that every day, and that is at blog.cron.com/techblog.
Thank you. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Vosh Bodie.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 20th, 2011. The Obama administration announced a new immigration policy this week that could end deportation threats against the foreign national partners of thousands of binational, same-gender couples living in the United States. The new guidelines direct immigration authorities on a case-by-case basis to focus on high-priority deportation proceedings against those convicted of crimes or who are considered to be security risks. Otherwise, law-abiding foreign national partners of gay or lesbian U.S. citizens who've overstayed their visas would be low-priority targets. A senior Obama administration official, speaking on condition of anonymity, confirmed that the prosecutorial discretion memo provides for the use of discretion for people with strong community ties, with community contributions, and with family relationships. We consider LGBT families to be families in this context. Heterosexual Americans can sponsor their foreign national spouses for work permits and residency. DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, prohibits the federal government from similarly recognizing same-gender couples who've legally married in jurisdictions that offer it. The U.S. Justice Department has stopped defending DOMA in federal court cases challenging the law's constitutionality. The new immigration policy now offers the Obama administration a chance to chip away at the impact of DOMA on binational couples.
Attorney Lottie Soloway, founder of Stop the Deportations, told the Washington Blade that Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano will now have the opportunity to stop every deportation involving a lesbian or gay binational couple. The new policy had an immediate impact on a Mexican lesbian national living in Denver, Colorado, who was facing deportation and separation from her wife. Sujay Pando has been in the country illegally since her parents brought her into the U.S. when she was 16, and then kicked her out of the house when she came out to them as a lesbian. She legally married her longtime girlfriend, Violeta Pando, in Iowa in 2010. Citing the new policy, an immigration judge ruled late this week that deportation proceedings for Sujay be delayed until January. But Steve Rails of the group Immigration Equality noted that the new immigration guidelines affect only those threatened with deportation, and that his group is still waiting on the administration to provide some relief for all couples, even before they are out of status, and before they are already facing the prospect of imminent removal. The new guidelines also cover the U.S.-born children of immigrants in the country illegally who know no other home but the United States. The DREAM Act, repeatedly defeated in Congress, would allow such young immigrants to earn legal status by completing 2 years of college or military service. They would also be low-priority deportation targets under the new guidelines.
A Ugandan man, described as obviously gay by many of his supporters, was spared deportation from Britain virtually at the last minute this week by the UK Border Agency. 32-year-old Robert Singwanyi got word of his reprieve less than an hour before he was supposed to board a flight back to his homeland. He says he was harassed and burned with molten plastic while in Uganda and feared he would be killed or jailed on his return to the deeply homophobic country. Singwanyi's Lib Dem Portsmouth area MP Mike Hancock and Ugandan Anglican Church Bishop Christopher Sinyojo, who's currently in Britain, have each strongly lobbied officials on his behalf. The British Home Office issued a statement saying that Singwanyi's deportation has only been delayed because his attorneys have submitted new legal documents. But the statement said, the government will not remove asylum seekers who have genuinely had to leave particular countries because of their sexual orientation or gender identification. Uganda is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for sexual minorities. Private consensual adult gay sex is already harshly punished there, and a globally condemned bill to punish aggravated homosexuality with the death penalty is still pending in Parliament.
In other news, hundreds of LGBT people held a historic rally this week in Nepal to demand that their rights be included in a new constitution being drafted for the South Asian country. The demonstration, which the Associated Press said was led by two decorated elephants and live bands to draw people into the street, was held not in cosmopolitan Kathmandu, but about 100 miles south of the capital city in Narayangat, a primarily rural area. Colorfully dressed participants danced to the music and held up banners that said, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights are human rights. Similar demonstrations have been held in the past few years in Kathmandu during the primarily Hindu nation's traditional festival of Gai Jatra, which honors the dead. But activists called the first time they've rallied outside the capital city a milestone. High-profile LGBT rights activist and Nepal's only openly gay member of parliament, Sunil Pant, said that sexual minorities have grown increasingly comfortable in his country's urban areas and that now we are campaigning for the people in the villages and rural parts to come out and join us.
A transgender woman who underwent Cuba's first state-sanctioned gender reassignment surgery in 2007 legally married a gay man on August 13th in Havana. The union of 37-year-old Wendy Iripa and 31-year-old gay activist Ignacio Estrada was not considered to be a same-gender marriage. They aren't legal in the country because Iripa is officially female. But Reuters reported that the civil ceremony was tinged with politics as some of Cuba's best-known dissidents participated and U.S. diplomats attended in a public show of support. After the ceremony, the couple wrapped themselves in a large rainbow flag to walk through the streets. This is the first wedding between a transsexual woman and a gay man, said Estrada. We celebrated at the top of our voices and affirmed that this is a step forward for the gay community in Cuba. The couple called their wedding a gift to Fidel Castro on his 85th birthday. The former Cuban leader apologized last year for how gay people were treated during his iron-fisted rule in the 1960s. Thousands of sexual minorities were jailed or sent to re-education camps as counter-revolutionaries. Mariela Castro, the former leader's niece and daughter of current President Raul Castro, heads the National Sex Education Center and is the country's most prominent advocate for LGBT rights. She didn't attend the wedding, but sent a message to the happy couple who were said to be honeymooning at an undisclosed location.
Mexico City's civil registry announced this week that 1,000 same-gender weddings have been celebrated in the capital since a marriage equality law took effect there on March 4, 2010. The legislation also included adoption rights. According to the published statistics, the first 1,000 weddings involved 548 gay couples and 452 lesbian couples. About 85% of the marriages were between partners aged 31 and older, which is a few years older than the national average for heterosexual marriages. The city registry also noted that foreign nationals made up about 6% of the same-gender partners getting married. The milestone 1,000th wedding that took place on August 14th was, in fact, between a 37-year-old Mexican university researcher and a 29-year-old Dutchman. Legislation to open marriage in Mexico City to gay and lesbian couples was passed in December 2009, and the Capital District remains the only place in the country where same-gender couples can legally wed. Mexico's Supreme Court ruled last year, however, that those marriages must be recognized nationwide.
But the Associated Press reported this week that only 9 same-gender couples took advantage of the new civil unions law in the U.S. state of Rhode Island in July, the first month it was open to them. Even for the smallest state in the country by land area, with a population of 1 million people, LGBT rights advocates say that the poor response proves that civil unions are a poor substitute for full civil marriage equality. People are holding out for marriage, according to Don Ewer of Marriage Equality Rhode Island. They want true equality, she said, not a made-up bureaucratic second-class status. But Chris Plant of the National Organization for Marriage Rhode Island claimed that the fact that gays and lesbians have not exercised this new right shows that the only thing they want to do is redefine marriage.
Maine's chapter of the National Organization for Marriage has already started raising money in that state to oppose a proposed marriage equality initiative on the November 2012 ballot. State officials approved the exact language of the initiative petition this week, and supporters must now gather about 57,000 valid signatures to get it qualified. The proposed text includes religious exemptions and is reportedly patterned on the marriage equality bill that was recently enacted in New York. Maine lawmakers approved a marriage equality bill in 2009. But the law was repealed at the ballot box by 53% of the electorate that same year. Organizers of the proposed new initiative believe that public attitudes have changed since then. Opponents say that the issue has already been debated and decided. Lesbian and gay activists in Oregon are weighing the pros and cons of putting a marriage equality measure on their state ballot. Voters approved a ban on same-gender marriage there in 2004.
And finally, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin fulfilled a campaign promise this week when he officiated at the wedding of a lesbian couple, which was a first for a sitting U.S. governor. The first-term Democrat married Anne and Michelle Mitch Beck during a small civil ceremony in his office. The couple approached him at a meet-and-greet campaign event last June to thank him for championing the marriage equality bill in Vermont when he was state Senate President pro tem. The gubernatorial candidate promised to preside at their wedding if he was elected. Shumlin reportedly spent $100 to obtain a certificate as a temporary officiate in order to perform the ceremony. I had to pull big strings to make this happen, he said. This isn't in my job description.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 20th, 2011. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Propp. Read the text of this week's News Wrap online at thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Vosh Bodie.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Daniel Williams.
And Daniel, we have a special treat tonight. You remember here several weeks ago, there was the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation, the memorial.
Yes, the Montrose Remembrance Garden.
It's absolutely wonderful. And we talked about that at length. Well, tonight we have Douglas Anderson and Alan Everett, who are with the foundation. And we're not going to be talking necessarily about the foundation and memorial, which we always can do, because there's you had told me off microphone that there's some stuff happened. But what we want to talk about now is what has evolved from what happened to Aaron Sherhorn. And for those of you who don't remember, Aaron was stabbed to death and had tried to seek shelter within one of our local clubs, who denied him entry and subsequently may have cost him his life.
And when was this?
This was when?
December 10th, 2010.
And because of that, there has been something created, and I'm going to give you that. What came out of this tragedy?
Well, thanks. First, I want to thank you, Jennifer and Daniel, for having me on the show, and Alan on the show again. Yeah, what's came from this tragedy? Well, initially, I had a lot of anger and a lot of sadness, and through the help with a lot of great individuals, people like Alan here, Jack Valinsky, a lot of help from the GLBT Community Center, we've been able to form this Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change. And we wanted to honor our friend Aaron by giving some gifts back to our community.
Mm-hmm.
And one being the Remembrance Garden. And one that I hold near and dear to my heart is Aaron's Angels.
Hmm. Now, Aaron's Angels is... since I know a little bit more than our listeners may do, is a part of the Citizens on the Patrol project within the Houston Police Department.
That's correct.
And what is it Aaron's Angels are going to do?
Well, we hope to be not only a the eyes and ears of HPD, but we'd also like to be a positive presence in the community.
How so?
Well, to possibly get across to individuals information that would be relevant to their personal lives, like maybe, domestic violence, drug or alcohol addiction.
And how does Aaron's Angels go about doing this?
Well, we have been discussing different ways of getting this information across. There's been some involvement with Montrose Counseling Center and their domestic violence and addiction programs, as and getting some information cards that we hand out when we're out on patrol to individuals that show some interest in, like, the gay and lesbian switchboard.
Mm-hmm. So how do these patrols work?
Well, it was all based upon information I received back in January at our first meeting at the GLBT Community Center concerning the now, I guess, historic Q Patrol.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that I was here after the Broussard murder.
Yeah.
And what came out of that was Q Patrol, mm-hmm. which is very similar. And for those of us who may not remember those days, that this was, again, citizens on patrol. Before cell phones, they used walkie-talkies, and they patrolled the neighborhood and reported to police any suspicious behavior.
That's correct, yeah.
So is that basically what the Angels are going to do?
Yes, it is. Again, we only want to be the eyes and ears of HPD. We're not going to carry any guns. We're by no means an authoritative group. We just want to be a positive presence in the community, day or night.
Douglas, tell us more about from your perspective.
That's Alan.
I mean, Alan.
Well, we're out there not only to be the eyes and ears of the police department, but we're out there to help people who are in need. There may be people who are homeless, or there may be people who need shelter, or who have been victims of violence in some way. And so if we see somebody who looks like they need help, or if someone approaches us asking what we're doing out there, we'll tell them what we're doing, and we'll give them resources. We'll have phone numbers and resource information for them.
That's an excellent expansion of simply the patrol, but giving them the appropriate information to help alleviate whatever problem they may have.
Now, I'm not that familiar with Citizens on Patrol, I have to admit. When the Q Patrol was formed, I was 12. So, how does one get involved
That's
with Citizens on Patrol?
It's actually a program of the Houston Police Department. It's like a neighborhood. Most people know it as the Neighborhood Watch Program. They have these all over the city of Houston. The police department will go into a neighborhood, and the Neighborhood Civic Association may pair up with the Houston Police Department and say, we want to have a neighborhood watch program. What do we do? And the HPD gives us, there's a training session you go to where they tell you what you can do and what you cannot do. You're not to engage. If you see any suspicious activity, you're not to engage with them at all. You're just supposed to report things that look like they're out of order or not. You know, if you see illegal activity going on, or if you see, for heaven forbid, if you see an assault, or you see a fire, even if you see a fire, or you see vandalism or graffiti, you call in the Houston Police Department,
so
a non-emergency number, and tell them what's going on. If it is an emergency, then you call 911, same as any citizen can do.
So the volunteers who are working with Aaron's Angels attend this training that's given by HPD, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And Alan and Douglas, have you all been through the training?
Yes, we have, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was very informative. You know, whenever we first thought about doing this, and I went to HPD to discuss it with them. I actually thought they were going to tell me to go home and stay inside and let us handle the police work. But actually, they were very enthused about it. They actually need our help. I've discovered that our city's resources are kind of stretched to the limit right now with the budget shortfalls and so forth. I'm sitting here looking at this form that is a report form that's filled out monthly, and some of the things that we were instructed on was like just noticing stuff that's doesn't seem just right, you know, like maybe an open door on a neighbor's house, a car window that's rolled down but it's been sitting there for a couple days. Normally, if it doesn't seem right to you, then your instinct is probably correct. One of the things about Aaron's Angels, though, as opposed to just your standard COP patrol, is say you had a citizens on patrol group in the Woodlands. There's crime going on there, but they don't have the rampant people standing along the streets like you have here in the Montrose area, like along Fairview, you know, where it's just obvious drug dealing and going on and so forth. And I myself am in recovery, and I really do feel for these people out there who are trapped in the cycle of addiction. And I do an agreement with my fellow Aaron's Angels have come to realize that we also can use this as a resource of information, getting the information out there to the addict and alcoholic on the street. You know, because part of this crime wave that we've experiencing is drug related. You know, Aaron's killer was a known drug dealer. He has a criminal record of check fraud, credit card fraud, armed robbery, just all sorts of stuff, you know. One of the other things that we have here with us tonight, Jennifer, is our safe shelter agreement. We brought this. We put this agreement together based upon what happened that December night when Aaron was turned away from that nightclub.
Now, that's probably one of the single things, which was the outrage at the time that there was an opportunity for that club to have assisted and possibly saved his life, but by turning him away, they almost guaranteed his death.
And I think more than just outrage, there was shock. I live literally around the corner from where Aaron was killed, and I was shocked that my neighborhood and my community would react that way to someone in need. So you have this community agreement. What does a business or an organization need to do to become a safe space?
Well, Daniel,
safe shelter.
Yeah. Again, just like Jennifer and you were stating, it was just a lot of outrage. You know, about a week or so after Aaron's murder, in the news was that attack in Arizona with the congresswoman.
Yes. Gabrielle Giffords.
Where the crowd actually attacked that guy and held him down and detained him until the authorities got there, you know. And this happened to Aaron in front of, I would say, at least 20 people standing in line to get into that nightclub. And the doorman just turned him away. He did exactly what any of us would do, and that would be run towards lights and people. And our community failed him that night.
And so as part of trying to fight that indifference, you've created this safe shelter program. How can I get involved with the safe shelter program?
Well, it's quite easy. I have an agreement here. I don't actually have my glasses. Alan, could you read this?
Alan, you get the job of informing us of the agreement.
This is a very short agreement that the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change had drafted and was, I wouldn't say certified, but looked over by the GLBT attorney, John Neachum. And we had him look it over to make sure businesses and club owners would sign it, not feeling that they would be liable for anybody's health or well-being. So I'll give you
out. I'll read you what the agreement says. It says, I, and then there's a blank. It says, as owner or manager of such and such a business, I hereby promise the following. to make reasonable efforts to provide a temporary safe haven for those who come to our business in need of shelter or assistance when faced with imminent threat of bodily harm or danger. Also, to provide such persons the use of a telephone or other modes of communication to contact the proper authorities, and to educate our business's staff of possible risks and dangers in the community and our business's intent to fulfill our promise under this agreement. By signing below, I acknowledge the importance of safety of our patrons, staff, and the community, and affirm our promise under this agreement to make reasonable measures to protect and provide a temporary safe haven and assistance for persons who request help from us when their lives are in imminent danger. And then it gives a place for them to sign and for us to sign.
Very simple, basic agreement.
We're not trying to put any businesses in jeopardy or create any liability for them. And so we've gone, to jump through hoops to try to make sure it doesn't put them in a liability, but still gives them an opportunity to, to agree or to, take a stand on taking care of people who are in need.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT, Houston.
And we're currently talking with Alan Everett and Douglas Anderson of the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation. We're talking about Aaron's Angels and the Safe Shelter Agreement. Actually, this agreement is basically just good common sense on the part of the businesses.
And good neighbors.
Yes, that we support. The community, the neighbors support. And, an incident like occurred with Aaron doesn't always promote good business, especially when that business turned away somebody.
And, Alan, you have this wonderful placard that businesses that agree to become safe shelters can put in their windows and display so that everyone can know that they are part of the safe shelter program, which is really exciting. How can I become involved with Aaron's Angels? I know you said there was a training. Do I need to have any specific qualifications?
Well, yeah, there are qualifications, and I found out about that a little bit too soon for the first training, but there is a requirement that a volunteer or prospective volunteer be able to pass a background check of no felonies for the past 10 years. There's all sorts of, legitimate reasons for that. We've been out on patrol, and it's pretty scary out there right now.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Yeah. Y'all are already out on patrol. Mm-hmm. How many patrols do you currently have?
We have a handful of people. We've only
I don't want to know the exact number because we don't want to give the evildoers information.
Well, we are growing. We've already had one training session, and we're about to have another training session on September 8th. Okay. And you can contact us on Facebook by looking at the Montrose Remembrance Garden. And from there, you can find Doug's contact information or my contact information.
Okay. Is there a website also?
There is not a website yet,
but we're going to have one.
Okay. You can also go on Facebook to the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change is another easy way.
And we'll get the link to the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change Facebook page on the Queer Voices Twitter feed. If you don't follow us on Twitter, please do. It's a wonderful way to get additional material from the show.
Okay. Now tell me, what is one of the patrols like?
Well, right now, it's very exhausting. It's really hot out.
When it's 100 degrees out there.
I hate to be such a hog in the mic, Alan, but we had a definite plan of what areas we wanted to be patrolled in. We had a request by one of the bar owners' business managers to patrol a particular area near the JR's mining company area right there. And it can be a little bit overwhelming. I mean, we would walk around and we would see individuals just standing on the corner, and you have this gut feeling that they're up to no good. You know, they stick out like a sore thumb, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Standing on a corner for God knows how long, you know, drinking a beer or whatever, you just know that they're not there just tourist watching.
And
you know?
And what does the training tell you to do?
Well, the
that?
Training tells us quite a bit. First and foremost is the safety of the volunteers. You know, people that are dealing drugs, this is their livelihood, and they take their money very seriously, you know. So we have to keep our distance. And what we do is we call in the drug activity on specific corners. Now, we do realize there's not going to be a patrol car sent right out. But what happens is, after numerous reports on a particular corner, then that will flag that corner for the police department to do like a sting on that corner to clear them out. Now, again, you think, okay, well, this would be like the pigeon effect. You'll shoo them, they'll land somewhere else. And I do realize that's probably going to be, you know, what will happen here in the beginning. Hopefully, we will be able to increase our volunteer staff and be a larger presence out there.
Well, the results of the Q Patrol back in the 80s is that a lot of the, it virtually stopped the bully boys from the Woodlands and Kingwood and the outlined areas coming into town just to beat up on the GLBT community.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that they would get caught, because that the 10 that murdered Broussard finally got caught.
Yeah.
Even though the police did not want to catch them, they didn't care. Ray Hill made sure they cared, and we found them.
Yeah, Aaron's killer, his home address is in Missouri City. Has a nice house. You can go on the Google Maps street vision or street view. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and see, it's that sort of thing. It's a matter of, like, it's without Aaron's Angels, it's like hunting season for those type of people.
Yeah. And it was really great. The first night we were out there, you know, East Montrose Association has the black SUV that is actually funded by area businesses in the East Montrose district. And we were out on foot. They were out in their SUV. And then HPD cars were out in the neighborhood. So we were, like, you know, out there in force, us three different groups.
Well, it sounds like y'all are just doing incredible work out there. Again, we've got the contact information for the organization on our Twitter feed. We've been talking with Douglas Anderson and Alan Everett of the Aaron Shearhorn Foundation for Change and their wonderful Aaron's Angels Citizens Patrol program.
I want to thank y'all for coming tonight. Is there anything else you want to cover before we close?
I just want to thank y'all for having us on the program again. Oh. Really, it's such an honor to be here, and it's really thrilling.
Well, thank you both, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
This is Queer Voices.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. 10 years after the tragedy of 9/11, Pacifica Radio will present a national broadcast featuring special programming from each Pacifica radio station and the archives that examines its impact on American society. We invite you, the listener, to be part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Hour by including your voice along with those of Stephen Rohde, Howard Zinn, Maxine Waters, June Jordan, Bertrand Russell, Jermaine Greer, and many others. Tell us about how you heard about the attack, what you did, how you feel 10 years later, or perhaps you heard something on Pacifica Radio that was extraordinary. The subject is wide open. Call us at 1-800-735-0230. We want to hear how 9/11 changed your life or your worldview. These will be part of the commemoration broadcast on September 11th, 2011. The message number, again, is 1-800-735-0230.
I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program.
I'm Victoria Oluwole.
I'm Gloria Johnson.
I'm Darnell Anderson.
AFS is a worldwide nonprofit organization that has been leading international high school student exchange for more than 60 years.
Each year, AFS USA welcomes 2,500 international high school students who come to study in U.S. high schools and live with host families.
We are looking for families in the Houston area to become host families to students arriving in August.
To learn more about hosting for the 2011-2012 school year, visit afsusa.org/hostfamily.
This has been a public service announcement brought to you by the Broadcast Journalism Program at Sharptown High School.
This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy. This way.
One of the organizations in our community that seems like it's been there forever is the Montrose Counseling Center. And anytime you think of the Montrose Counseling Center, you think of Anne Robinson. And you weren't there actually at the beginning. You weren't there with Ray when he was with the disciples and stuff like that. But you've been there almost from the beginning.
I came in about the 10th anniversary, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah, the 8th. Really? It just seems longer.
Well, and so how did you start? You're from Beaumont?
No, I'm from Pittsburgh.
You're from Pittsburgh.
Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And moved to Port Arthur with...
Okay, that's the connection.
Someone who is now an ex-husband, because he was in the oil business.
Of course.
And I didn't like Port Arthur much, so I moved to Austin to work for the state and then found my way back here when this position opened. So,
and what did you know about the community and the organization?
Well, when I worked in Beaumont, I ran the Rape Crisis Center there for 4 years, and I had... a client, a survivor, who was lesbian, and I was trying to get her mental health services, and there wasn't really anything in Beaumont, or at least anything I could find. So someone told me about the counseling center. I called over. I talked to Jim Beecher, and he spent a lot of time with me. We got the client hooked up over here, and I remembered that when the job came open. And he, unfortunately, didn't get to meet him in person because he was gone by the time I came that way. But I'd had some professional experience with them before I came over here.
And at that time, the counseling center was at 900 Lovett?
Yeah, that's where it was when I
came here. And it was like, what, a couple rooms?
It was... up the stairs, and maybe 6 or 7 rooms up there in the big round room, which every time you closed the doors, the carpet would raise. and then by the time we left, we had taken over most of that end of it, and that building was slated to be demolished, so we had to get out. And we just kind of lucked into, found the space on 701 Richmond.
And there must have been some really tough times.
Well, when I came on, they were in some tough times. They were coming out of it, but there had been, in the early days of HIV, there wasn't much money except for the community fundraisers. None of the foundations would touch HIV. The United Way wasn't there yet, and the government money hadn't started really flowing yet. So the counseling center didn't turn people away, and had some volunteers running groups, but also, you know, had some staff that were seeing people who were grieving and people who were dying, and they... At that time, when I got there, they were, as Marion likes to say, and some of my former boomers like to say, we were emptying the Coke machine to make payroll. And that was true.
But you did make payroll.
So, yeah. But there was, I mean, our receptionist was a retired teacher, so he had a pension. And I was still married at the time, so I had something to fall back on. So we held our paychecks until everybody else got paid to see what was left, and then we'd cash our paychecks.
Like many other organizations of its kind around the country, it was it's, and you're the expert on this, was this sort of a new road being paved at the time, that GLBT people had somewhere to go dealing with issues of mental health?
There may be a couple of places older in the country, but not in Texas. We were the first group in Texas, and I'm told, I wasn't there at the time, but I'm told that Oak Lawn was, what used to be Oak Lawn, was founded based on what they've learned from Montrose Counseling Center, and same with the Austin group and then the Fort Worth group. And what we like to say when we're writing grants and we're talking to people is that back then, the reason the agency was formed is that people who, GLBT people, and at that time just even gay people, if they wanted to get counseling, they had a choice between agencies that maybe they had somebody gay working there, but they really didn't have a culture of accepting or even knowing much about the gay culture, or try to find somebody who's in private practice who's gay. And we were formed so that people who needed help wouldn't have to explain what it's like to be gay, and could just talk about their problems that may have something to do with them being gay and may not. But, you know, they didn't, if you go to an agency that doesn't understand the culture, isn't immersed in the culture, you spend most of your time trying to educate your therapist. And so we try to make that not happen. So it's a safe, affirming place to come and be whoever you are, because we have some people that, you know, some people that are in the neighborhood that are straight that come because it's convenient, and we have people who come from Shreveport and Victoria and even Corpus because it's a place they trust and they feel comfortable.
And you basically do this on a sliding scale.
We do a great deal of our services are free because we've been lucky to get some grant money. And I mean, the HIV money came first. And actually, I think we had a substance abuse treatment grant before the HIV money. But the HIV money came first, and that was probably the first part of the government that got used to working with gay agencies, because that's where HIV kind of started.
So was that the transition of mostly community-based money to be able to get some grants?
Yeah, it was. HIV started it, and then we were able to beef up our substance abuse treatment stuff, and then, believe it or not, under George W. Bush as governor, we got some money through the governor's office for anti-violence work. They handle some of the criminal justice money, and we did it for, use it for counseling and case management and our hotline.
Well, and you brought some other organizations under your umbrella too in recent years.
We did. We approached, and actually one of our staff was on their board, we approached the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard of Houston, because in order to be a rape crisis center and a domestic violence shelter, you got to have a hotline. And we figured that was a well-known number in the community. It was well thought of, well supported. And we'd heard they just were running out of steam. And they were down to about one volunteer and a couple of board members, one of them, Jimmy Carver, who were getting tired and were, you know, but wanted to somebody to pick it up that was going to honor it and keep it going forward. So we turned it into 24 hours, and that's our gateway to getting anti-violence services.
Do you, is the need being met? I mean, you rely on as much grant money, and I heard you're an incredible expert on writing these grants, that because you not only have to run the organization, you have to raise the money.
Well, I have some help now that I didn't have in the beginning. We've got a small development staff, and we got a couple people. We got one guy who's just really, really good at it, and he's gaining expertise with the government grants, but he's really good at the foundation grants and community groups, and we have a events person. And of course, we have Sally. Everybody knows Sally.
Yes. Well, that's sort of the amazing thing. I mean, we talk a lot about the Montrose Counseling Center here on this show, the different programs you do, but you let other people take the limelight of talking about these
Well, Sally's our point person with the media, and while KPFT, we don't always think of KPFT as the media for as our concerns, because it feels like almost a sister organization, because it's in Montrose and been very, very, very friendly to what we do. But yeah, Sally is our point person with the media. But when we have something, you know, she's been very good at getting us called upon by the mainstream media when there's some current event that has to do with one of the issues we work on. And I would prefer that one of our counselors, who is an expert in the issue, be the point person to be interviewed instead of me, that they're just giving me talking points to say. I mean, I know about the issues, but they really, I mean, they're licensed and they work with clients every day, so they have that real world connection in their head that they can work with. So, but it's, I mean, it's just not about me. It's about the agency and the services. And I would hope that when I eventually retire, that the place goes on, because I think the people do great work and we've got a great staff and they have a lot of heart.
Did you envision that it would grow to how it has?
No.
No.
No. When I worked at that Rape Crisis Center in Beaumont, it was me and a half-time educator and a quarter-time secretary. And so, you know, I went from that to the state where, you know, you don't get any resources. And
especially in Texas.
Yeah. And then to this. And it was 13 people when I started. Not enough to even have to have, I know the big debate was whether or not we would take maternity coverage on our insurance, because you didn't have to under 15, and whether or not anybody was going to need that. And now we've got 70 employees.
Wow.
But no, I did not think. And it's just kind of, you know, we've had little jumps, but the rest of it's just been kind of when we hear from the community or from clients that there's an unmet need or they're not being served well by other agencies, and we've tried, we try to figure out how to get some money in to be able to do it.
So do you work with other agencies where you try to fill a gap if it's not being filled, or they try to fill the gap?
Sure. I mean, just for instance, we work with all the other domestic violence programs. I meet with all the directors every other month, and our staff meet in lots of different collaboratives. But, you know, it's not that those other agencies don't have good people, that they don't even have maybe gay people working there, and it's not that they don't want to, but just as the easiest example that help people understand why Montrose Counseling Center needs to exist and is unique and is not passé, is that men can't go into a women's shelter. And lesbians who go into a women's shelter, they may not be safe from their batterer, because their batterer could easily just follow them in. And it's real hard, even for us, it's real hard to screen and figure out who's the batterer when it's a same-sex couple.
Yeah.
But when you spend 99.9% of your time working with women and their children, it's not something you develop an expertise on. So it just felt like we needed to do it. And so we researched it and jumped in, because it was an unmet need. Now, there's not a lot of people that we serve in domestic violence shelter, but those we do serve, I think we save their lives.
Is there still a stigma of people seeking help?
Oh, sure. There's even a stigma to people giving money to an agency like ours, that mental health, people who have been addicted to substances, people think that there's either a defect with them, or they brought it on themselves, or it's just, you know, something we shouldn't talk about. And we work with Mental Health America and several other groups to help educate the community and make it so, you know, we should talk about it. And It's in everybody's family. I bet you everybody listening, if they thought about it, there's somebody in their family that if they didn't get mental health care, they should have. And same with the addiction treatment.
And then there was sort of a double stigma being GLBT.
Of course. And but we do get people who, it's not a mental health problem as you would normally think of. It's not, you know, a diagnosis of depression and all that. But somebody decides they're going to come out to their family at Christmas and their family rejects them. Well, that's traumatic. And they're, if they're not, if they haven't prepared themselves for that possibility, it can be really, really an abandonment and a violation. So we, you know, we even work with that, that people who feel like their religion or their family or their friends just aren't ready to support them because they've told them who they are.
There is a whole other element of youth that years ago when anybody in our community wanted to try to help youth, they're always thought of, well, we're recruiting them.
Yeah.
So that's why originally Hatch, and then mm-hmm. Hatch became part of the Montrose Counseling Center. Mm-hmm. And I actually spoke a number of years ago, and how I was just so impressed how the way the system works so that the kids are safe.
We're pretty careful. We took Hatch on as a program, I think, in 2002. And maybe it was 2000. Anyway, Deb has been with, she came with them, and she's been the mama bear ever since. And at the Pride Parade, we were, you know, we have monitors to keep folks away and certain little signals so the kids know who's safe. But when we build out that first floor of the counseling center, if anybody's been there, it's kind of a community meeting space, and we wanted Hatch to be there, and Hatch had always been a secret where they met, and we wanted to bring them on site, partly because it was cheaper, but also partly because the youth needed to see the community, and there was some concern, but we worked through that, and we have made sure that the rooms that the Hatch youth are in are safe, that we have private bathrooms so that youth can go to the bathroom by themselves and not have to worry about being, you know, nervous in the bathroom. But it's very important to us, and we work with Child Protective Services, we work with all kinds of other professional agencies, and they consider us to be, well, besides a lifesaver for some of these youth, but they consider us to be equal to them, and respect what we're doing with gay youth, because sometimes they'll call us and say, we don't know what to do.
And you're the experts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, not me, but my staff. Yes. I mean, we get called by DePelchin when they've got somebody that, and they just need some help and some guidance.
You talked about the first floor. You went into that building how long ago?
2006.
And you pretty much filled it up.
We have. We bought that building, our endowment bought that building in 2006, and we built out the second and third floor for Montrose Counseling Center. But the first floor we wanted to be open to the community, and we charge a little bit for the meeting rooms, but not so much that it's prohibitive for community groups. And we have eight tenants now that are, I'm supposed to call them resident organizations, not tenants. We have eight resident organizations that have a synergy with our mission. They're either GLBT focused, or we have AIDS Foundation that's on the third floor with us, our education department. But then through the meeting rooms, there's seven meeting rooms there, and we've got everything from, to church organizations, to the Leather folks.
Their archives.
Yeah.
And you've had community meetings in there, too.
Lots and lots and lots. And we've even, you know, we've had Wanda Adams had her town hall meeting there. We've had, you know, commitment ceremonies there. We've had our big dinners. We've had the prom there. So it's really been
Had memorials there, too.
Yeah. So it's kind of open to everything, and we've tried to make it so it was accessible to everybody.
And it's working. It's
I think. Yeah. It's taken a little bit for it, but it's caught on year by year by year, and it's it might actually be paying for itself now.
And the building's located at 401, I've heard, Bernard or Branard.
Yeah.
And it's just a little bit off the major thoroughfare.
We're almost up against the spur, if people know what that is. But the building was originally built by Harris County as a county building, and Child Protective Services was in it, 1965. So we're kind of proud of rehabbing an old building in the neighborhood and making some good use out of it.
And yes, I know neighborhood organizations have said they're happy to have you there, which isn't always the case. But where do you see the future going in mental health dealing with the GLBT community?
Well, I'll tell you, healthcare reform is something that if it continues to go through, which we're planning on that, our agency and every other agency and every private practitioner that's dealing with mental health, substance abuse, or healthcare has got to get ready for it. And that means, you know, there may be a lot less Ryan White money, and because most of the people that are qualified now will be Medicaid. We have to be prepared that we have Medicaid eligible providers. We have our billing system in order. That's on the administrative side.
That has to work.
It has to work, or we have to be able to prepare ourselves for that, or the people who want to come to see a counselor there won't be able to. They'll have to go someplace else. And I don't believe in having somebody pay up front and then get reimbursed from their provider. That's a lot of people do that, and it would be a lot less headache for us, but I think that it's a lot more troublesome, and it's a bigger deal for the clients because you have to deal with your insurance company, and who wants to do that when you're sick physically, let alone you're, you know, depressed or grieving or whatever. So, and on the other front, just on the clinical front, you know, the DSM-4 is being worked on now by the psychiatrists in the psychiatric community to become, I don't know if it's a DSM-5, maybe.
What does that mean?
Well, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's the fourth edition, and it's what all the psychologists and psychiatrists use. They get these little numbers that mean diagnosis. And there are some things in there that are being revisited that do affect the gay community. Now, I don't know if I can come up with all of them, but I know there are some issues around the transgender identity disorder that some people are trying to make that not be a condition or a diagnosis. And there's still, you know, all these people that, like Michelle Bachman's husband, who do reparative therapy, and there's, you know, always a tussle over that. So there are some things that we're watching, and other people who are progressive-minded are watching in that arena.
And I know you don't get into politics, but it does matter what politics determine what is.
Well, the agency doesn't, but I might. I'm known for having my debate watching parties at my kitchen. But it does matter. I mean, you really, if you care about it, you got to watch it, and you've got to, you know, whoever you vote for, it's important you vote.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you said you now have like how many people working over there?
We have 70. That includes some part-time people, but it's 70. Mm-hmm.
And people who come in for therapy are very much isolated from the other activities of the organization.
Yeah, we have...
There's a confidentiality.
We have a clinical floor, and one side is counseling, the other side is case management. All of our administration is on the top floor, and all of our outreach workers and educators are on the top floor, and all of the community meetings are on the first floor. So, I mean,
it's amazing how that worked out.
I know. I mean, it was by design. we have somebody who works for us who's a therapist, who's a supervisor now, whose first career was as an architect. And so he and I were drawing on these pieces of paper trying to, you know, draw out what we thought we needed to make it successful. But we were real happy to move into the building because it gave us better security. And every one of our counselors had an office, and we had windows. And that's real important to be able to have that, you know, light coming in. That's kind of reaffirming.
Wow. So you've had an interesting career.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, my parents worked one place their entire life, and I haven't just worked one place, but I've been there for it'll be 23 years this year, and I never thought that I would do that. And certainly I watch people who are younger, you know, kind of come and go, and they're restless and they want to go to the next great thing. But and maybe it makes a difference because I'm the boss, you know, that I get to have a lot of say. But it's a great place to work. I enjoy the staff. I enjoy the clients. I enjoy the board and the community. So I can't see a reason to go anywhere else.
Well, I certainly appreciate you coming by. I know that you'd rather send some of your other people to talk about the organization, and they do a great job. Mm-hmm. But it's real nice to hear from you because you've seen the overview. You worked all these years to build it up and to provide a service to the community. And I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And I do have to say one thing before... If I don't know what our timeline is, but Sally will kill me if I don't talk about the smoking cessation classes that start on the 23rd, and you have to go to the first one, but go to our website, and they're free. But if you want to quit, come to the smoking cessation classes, free.
And you can find out all that information at montrosecounselingcenter.org.
Absolutely.
There is all the information about all the different classes, or you can just call. And what's the number?
713-529-0037.
And Ann Robinson, who is almost the founder, not quite, has really helped build that organization. And I appreciate you coming by this evening. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Hi, I'm Rick Watts, and as one of the newscasters for This Way Out's News Wrap, my voice may be familiar to you. But what you may not know is that there are a great many reasons I strongly support the important work that This Way Out does and the important resource that it provides around the world. And only with your help, too, does this good work continue. Please log on to www.thiswayout.org to read my special message to you. Thanks.
According to some, our upcoming guest should display all the horrifying effects of being raised by lesbians. Decide for yourself how he turned out after one of the great poets gives us the 164.
164 equals PD, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Walt Whitman, the father of modern American literature, was one of the first modern writers to incorporate sexual desire into his poetry. But afraid to explicitly assert his own homosexuality, he substituted the vague phrase, the love of comrades. He was even secretive in his own journals to hide the identity and gender of a significant person in his life. It's clear from his manuscripts in the Library of Congress that the pronoun him was erased and her written over it. In addition, a name was written as 164, a simple numerical disguise. The 16th letter of the alphabet is P, the 4th is D, revealing the name Peter Doyle. Whitman and Doyle, in fact, shared a significant relationship for over 20 years, and in 1873, Doyle lived with Whitman and attended to him daily while the poet was recovering from a stroke. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mike Kleinerman.
follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
He became an internet sensation by being a sensational son. This Way Out's Steve Pride tells the family-friendly story, Zach Has Two Mommies.
On February 4th, a 19-year-old University of Iowa student spoke before the Iowa House of Representatives and urged lawmakers not to pass legislation which would ban same-sex unions in his state. Unions that the Iowa State Supreme Court had declared legal in 2009. His speech was amazing, heartfelt, personal, and found its way onto YouTube.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Zach Walls. I'm a sixth-generation Iowan and an engineering student at the University of Iowa, and I was raised by two women. My biological mom, Terry, told her grandparents that she was pregnant, that the artificial insemination had worked, and they wouldn't even acknowledge it. It actually wasn't until I was born and they succumbed to my infantile cuteness that they broke down and told her that they were thrilled to have another grandson. And unfortunately, neither of them lived to see her marry her partner, Jackie, of 15 years, when they wed in 2009. My younger sister and only sibling was born in 1994. We actually have the same anonymous donor, so we're full siblings, which is really cool for me. And I guess the point is that our family really isn't so different from any other Iowa family. You know, when I'm home, we go to church together, we eat dinner, we go on vacations. But we have our hard times too, we get in fights. Actually, my mom, Terry, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2000. It is a devastating disease that put her in a wheelchair, so we've had our struggles. But, you know, we're Iowans. We don't expect anyone to solve our problems for us. We'll fight our own battles. We just hope for equal and fair treatment from our government. Being a student at the University of Iowa, the topic of same-sex marriage comes up quite frequently in classroom discussions. You know, and the question always comes down to, well, can gays even raise kids? And the question, you know, the conversation gets quiet for a moment because most people don't really have an answer. And then I raise my hand and say, actually, I was raised by a gay couple and I'm doing pretty well. I scored in the 99th percentile on the ACT. I'm actually an Eagle Scout. I own and operate my own small business. If I was your son, Mr. Chairman, I believe I'd make you very proud. I'm not really so different from any of your children. My family really isn't so different from yours. After all, your family doesn't derive its sense of worth from being told by the state, you're married, congratulations. No, the sense of family comes from the commitment we make to each other, to work through the hard times so we can enjoy the good ones. It comes from the love that binds us. That's what makes a family. So what you're voting here isn't to change us. It's not to change our families, it's to change how the law views us, how the law treats us. You are voting for the first time in the history of our state to codify discrimination into our Constitution. A Constitution that, but for the proposed amendment, is the least amended Constitution in the United States of America. You are telling Iowans that some among you are second-class citizens who do not have the right to marry the person you love. So will this vote affect my family? Would it affect yours? Over the next 2 hours, I'm sure we're going to hear plenty of testimony about how damaging having gay parents is on kids. But in my 19 years, not once have I ever been confronted by an individual who realized independently that I was raised by a gay couple. And you know why? Because the sexual orientation of my parents has had zero effect on the content of my character. Thank you very much.
Since that day, the video of Zach's speech has been viewed some 2 million times. And he's appeared on over 50 news and talk shows. And now...
My name is Zach Walls. I'm 19 years old. I'm an engineering student at the University of Iowa. I'm studying environmental engineering and sustainability studies. I'm from Iowa City, which is where I'm also going to college. We moved to Iowa City from Wisconsin in 2000. I was born in Marshfield, Wisconsin. If you look at a map of Wisconsin, it's like right in the middle is where I was born. And Iowa... If, you know, you don't really know where that is just west of Chicago. Where I live is 4 hours west of Chicago on I-80, just kind of a straight shot west.
I wasn't sure where Iowa was, but I did have this image in my mind of Iowa being middle America, apple pie, flags. So not only was I astounded by what you did, I was astounded that it was legal for gays to marry in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big decision. In 2005, Varnum v. Breen was filed the lawsuit that eventually made its way to the Iowa Supreme Court. And by unanimous decision, 7-0, the judges ruled that Iowa's legislative ban on gay marriage was unconstitutional due to the Equal Rights Clause of the Iowa Constitution, and that then struck down the law, which cleared the way for full marriage equality in Iowa, which was really cool. And it's really unexpected, too, because people think Iowa, you know, lots of corn, lots of pigs, lots of farmers, very middle of the country, kind of that heartland. I think that, you know, people think that on the coast you got these really progressive traditions. And people forget that the middle of the country has those, too. Iowa was actually one of the first states to allow women on equal basis with men into colleges, universities, and law schools. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled 17 years before Dred Scott that any so-called slave to enter Iowa was actually a free man. So we've had some of the strongest protections for minorities when they've been most needed, and that is a tradition and legacy that lives on today.
Tell me about your mom.
Terry Lynn Walls, my biological mom, was a single lesbian physician in 1989 when she decided she wanted to have children. Everybody thought she was crazy, and for all practical purposes, she was. And it took a lot of work being a single woman, and then on top of that, a lesbian woman, to get access to reproductive technologies. But she ultimately found a sperm bank in Fairfax, Virginia, that was more than happy to work with her. So then 1991 was when I was born. And then just a few weeks after she had me, she decided she wanted to have another kid. Clearly, she hadn't had me for long enough. But then, sure enough, in 1994, she had my younger sister, Zebby, short for Zebediah. And Zach is short for Zachariah. So two biblical names, which I thought was, in retrospect, kind of interesting choice on her part. And then she met Jackie, her wife, in 1995. They dated for a while. Terry wasn't entirely sure if she wanted to be in a relationship or not. She'd had a couple of relationships that broke her heart. And so she was comfortable not being in a relationship and raising kids on her own. But then she ultimately wound up having a commitment ceremony with Jackie in 1996, which, you know, if that hadn't happened, you know, when she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, we would have been in a really, really tough place. We were in a tough place already with Jackie on board, but, you know, just the three of us alone, it probably would have been impossible. In 2000 was when we moved from Wisconsin down to Iowa. And 2000 was also the year that Terry was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Now, she didn't tell me and Zebby at that point. She didn't want to scare us or whatever. I was only going into the fourth grade, and Zebby was just starting elementary school. So we didn't really know until a little bit later. So then we moved to Iowa in 2000, and then it was in 2009 that same-sex marriage was legalized in Iowa by that Supreme Court decision, Barnum v. Breen.
How old were you when they had the commitment ceremony?
I would have been 5 years old.
Did you know what was going on?
Well, it's funny. I didn't realize that they weren't actually married until 2000 or so. Because for all practical purposes, you know, I watched them walk down the aisle. I watched them stand in front of a minister and exchange vows. In my eyes, and I think, you know, in their own eyes, they were married. And I think for us, that was in a lot of ways enough. We don't seek validation of our family from anybody else. We validate our own relationships and our own family. But the fact of the matter is, we didn't have the legal rights and protections that we needed as a family, you know. And this is something I've kind of thought about a lot. The state has to recognize that love and that bond between two people. If you could show that the love between two gay people is somehow less than the love between two heterosexual people, maybe the state wouldn't need to recognize that relationship with the bonds and privileges of marriage, but you can't show that because it's not true. And thus, I think that really in and of itself is the biggest argument for the recognition of same-sex couples.
I mean, it sounds like you had this amazing family. When did you know that it was different?
This difference never really registered because it wasn't different. It was my family. The way its difference manifested was never at home. You know, I never, like, woke up one morning and was like, oh, my family's different. It was at school where, you know, people ask, what do your mom and dad do? And it'd be like, I don't understand the premise of the question. You know, it was like, no, it's just not the right question. And then, you know, there's this slow realization where, you know, you're in high school and being different becomes dangerous.
Kids are cruel.
Kids are cruel, you know, and I don't know where we get that from. I think, you know, a lot of it is that kids struggle at home with their own family situations, the need for attention. You can go down the list, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but kids become targets and difference is kind of the bullseye. And so, you know, growing up, it was one of those things where I was selective about with whom I discussed my family.
But if this was a Lifetime movie, there would be that parent that wouldn't let little Johnny go play at Zach's house.
Yeah, that happened. I lost friends. And it was never like one of those things where kids were like, oh, you've got gay parents, we can't be friends anymore. It was more of a phone call was made, and then all of a sudden, you know, like, Doug didn't come over to my house anymore. And this is just how it went. And so from the very beginning, my whole life has been this kind of this struggle to gain recognition, both for myself and for my family. And I can't wait to have that recognition. Because the fact of the matter is, if my moms were to have come with me out here to this interview, they wouldn't be married. When we go down to visit family in Florida, they're not married. And so those protections and rights and privileges no longer exist. You know, if we're in Texas and Terry stumbles and breaks something, Jackie can't go visit her in the hospital. And so until we've achieved these rights and protections on a national level, you know, I certainly won't be satisfied, but well, once that's done, I'm certainly looking forward to this no longer being an issue, I'll put it like that.
Same-sex marriage remains legal in Iowa. This has been a conversation with Zach Walls, a 19-year-old Iowan who loves his mom and his mom. Don't mess with his family. I'm Steve Pride.
Nice man, his name is Mark, he's always smiling. He's got this mom who comes on Wednesdays in the evening with soup so steaming.
He shares his house with his friend Martin. They're not brothers, they're not cousins. My little girl wonders all about these men. I take hold of her hand and I begin.
Home is where the heart is, no matter how the heart lives.
Inside your heart where love is, that's where you've got to make yourself happy.
The yard live Deb and Trisha with their tools and ladders and their room addition.
My kid yells over, are you having a baby? They wink and smile, they say, someday maybe.
But through their doors go kids and mommies.
Funny how you don't see the daddies going.
My little girl wonders about this house with no men. I take hold of her hand and I begin. Home is where the heart is, no matter how the heart lives. Inside your heart where love is, that's where you got to make yourself.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Vash Bodhi, Michael LeBeau, Rick Watts, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Mike Heinerman and Steve Pride contributed program material. Holly Neer and Mary Travers sang Home is Where the Heart Is, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and by our generous listeners. Thank you. Find out more at thiswayout.org, where you can link to our podcast and our blog. Like This Way Out Radio on Facebook and look for us in iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWORadio@AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on WOMR, Provincetown, Massachusetts, 3CR, Fitzroy, Victoria, Radio Free Asheville, Asheville, North Carolina, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. Name of the group, Sick of Sarah, the title of the song Shattered, from their album 2205, which was released last year. And we're playing that because Sick of Sarah will be at the Hard Rock Cafe this coming Saturday. That's the Hard Rock Cafe on Texas Avenue, if you would like to hear more of that, this Saturday. You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Would you like to feel more peace and happiness in your relationships and enhance your ability to communicate with others? Would you like a deeper awareness and acceptance of your feelings and needs, all of them? If you are curious about these possibilities, join us on September 15th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Dominican Center, 6501 Almeida, for a free 3-hour introduction to a process known as compassionate communication, or also known as nonviolent communication. This free 3-hour introduction will be followed by a 3-day training and facilitated by Raj Gill, the founder of the Freedom Project Canada. For more information, visit www.houstonnvc.org or phone Susan at 281-412-4564. Please join us.
Hi, I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program.
I'm Victoria Oluwole.
I'm Gloria Johnson.
I'm Darnell Anderson.
AFS is a worldwide nonprofit organization that has been leading international high school student exchange for more than 60 years.
Each year, AFS USA welcomes 2,500 international high school students who come to study in U.S. high schools and live with host families.
We are looking for families in the Houston area.